couple of years ago, we started a series of discussions about the lives of artists. And on the board, we would put down, it's really important what you put down on the board. And we were putting down things like Vincent van Gogh and Michelangelo and Domenico Theotocopoulos. People would look at the board and figure that there had to be something better that they could do during that time, and they didn't know what those things were. And even when they were told that those were the names of artists, it really wasn't something that they were interested in. So in order to establish a little PR, we decided to give the session a label, and we called it Rich's Crazy Friends. And they are still all artists. So now that you know that what we're going to do is talk about artists, I'll give you a couple minutes. You may want to get up and walk out. The word crazy is carefully chosen. It's not something it's not a word I use lightly with regard to these people, nor is it a word that I use in mockery or disrespect. It is a word which attempts to define particularly gifted people, special, for one reason or another. And artists, in addition to that reason, artists generally are thought of as crazy, as weird. And I am not here to dispute that. In fact, I guess I affirm it with my life and the things that I do, and I think that's fine. I think more people ought to affirm craziness in their own particular ways. But as soon as you say that someone is an artist, you already have some things in the back of your mind that you expect. You have some expectations of craziness to come from an artist. And I guess of all of the artists that I can think of that typify craziness, Vincent van Gogh is the one that does it best in a way that is probably more accessible to people without art backgrounds, what I like to call the great unwashed. he's popular with a lot of people, and he's become more popular in our time because of the kind of time we are. It's a time of anguish, a time of introspection, kind of time for despairing, and maybe even the celebrating of despair. So I thought it might be appropriate to start with Vincent. And on Thursday, I think it is, we'll do another Dutchman by the name of Rembrandt, who nobody thinks is crazy. In fact, most of us think he's God. And I that's why I include him in here, because he's just as crazy as the rest of us. And I'd like to prove that. We have to establish a kind of mindset when we start looking at Vincent's work, and it's a mindset that allows for a different sort of definition of sainthood. This is a year in which the village celebrates worshiping with all the saints. And whenever I refer to Vincent as Saint Vincent, some people, I think, get terribly upset because they know what kind of a life he led, what kind of habits he maintained. And yet, for me, certain aspects of his life lead me to concentrate on things of God that I never would have concentrated on if it hadn't been for his life. One of the remarkable things is love. Vincent's sense of love was so intense that it disgusted everybody. you couldn't shake him off. He would not be denied. He was like a puppy that you had just given, you know, you shook its paw, and now it won't stop following you around. And it follows you into your bedroom and into the kitchen and into the living room. And it puddles on your front porch and does all kinds of little puppy things. And all of a sudden, its love makes you terribly angry, and you want to get rid of it. Vincent's love was far out, and the reason that it was far out was that he took things terribly literally. Vincent was Franciscan. St. Francis of Assisi was really a model for Vincent, and Francis of Assisi was crazy too. I mean, I don't care what anybody says, he was a nut. And his nuttiness had to do with how literally he took the scriptures. And it got both Francis and Vincent in real trouble. In Vincent's case, he would do things like, you know, like how it says in the Bible, if a man asks you to walk a mile, walk with him too. Well, that would happen to Vincent. And a guy would ask Vincent to walk a mile, and Vincent would walk with him 2 miles, even though the guy was only going 1 mile. He would drag the guy the next mile. That's true. If a guy asked Vincent for half of his coat, Vincent would give him his whole coat, and there was nothing underneath. I mean, he was a flasher for Jesus. I mean, that's just, that's terrible. Terrible. Nobody wanted all of that. Just, you know, put it, you know, at least half of it, put it back on. But not Vincent. He loved very unlovable people. And I suppose that if he never painted a picture, he would be a part of history because of the letters that he wrote. Vincent's letters are so beautiful. They are so much an extension, like his paintings, of him. Whenever you look at a painting, no matter what the subject matter is, you are looking at a self-portrait of Vincent. Remember that, because we're going to look at maybe 40 paintings in a very short time. Every one of them is a self-portrait of Vincent. Every one of Vincent's letters is a self-portrait. I guess it's reading Vincent's letters that probably got me out of the letter writing business. I cannot get over a man who is so open and who talks about absolutely everything. Every color he saw that day is in his letters. And so the diary of Vincent is full of the most keen observations, the most astute analysis of his own personality, and he gave that away, and most of it to his brother Theo. The relationship between Vincent and his brother Theo is a very, very special relationship. Theo put up with Vincent through thick and thin, so much so that when Vincent would come to visit Theo, nobody else would come to visit Theo. And his social life went down, but he still helped support Vincent. He was the only one. And Vincent constantly needed money, assurance, all kinds of things from Tao, and Tao provided it. There is an incredible ending to the relationship of Vincent and Tao, which I'll save until the end. Vincent was a frustrated pastor. He was a minister. But he couldn't take Latin, Greek, and Hebrew. He didn't have the mental capacity for it. This man was a real artist. And so he couldn't get the ordination business taken care of in an official way. And yet he needed to be a pastor terribly. And so he went to school for lay pastors in Belgium. And he didn't do very well. That he got kicked out of that too. I guess he was a little aggressive. Or maybe he asked questions. That's a sure way to get kicked out of seminary. Finally, I think he decided that he would take a job that nobody else wanted. And so all of the calls that year had been distributed, and one little parish in the south of Belgium, where coal miners lived, had no one to go. There was no one to fill the vacancy, and so Vincent says, I'll take it. And so they sent him to this little place in the south of Belgium, which was, in today's vernacular, I learned at Etten. Etten was his father's parish. That you had sent 50 francs for me, well, I accepted them. Certainly with reluctance, certainly with a rather melancholy feeling, but I am up against a stone wall and in a sort of mess. How can I do otherwise? I am a man of passions, capable of and subject to doing more or less foolish things, of which I happen to repent more or less afterwards. Must I consider myself a dangerous man, incapable of anything? I do not think so. When I was in the surroundings of pictures and things of art, you know how I then had a violent passion for them. Even now, far from that land, I am often homesick for the land of pictures. Well, now I do not have those surroundings anymore. Yet that thing that is called soul, they say it never dies, but it lives always and goes on searching always and always and forever. Now, for more than 5 years already, I do not know exactly how long, I am more or less without employment, wandering here and there. You say, since a certain time, you have gone down, you have deteriorated, you have done nothing. Is this quite true? Is it true that now and then I have earned my crust of bread, now and then a friend has given it to me in charity? I have lived as I could, as luck would have it, haphazardly. It is true that I have lost the confidence of many. It is true that I might have done better. It is true that just for earning my bread, I've lost time. But is this what you call going down? But on the path I have taken now, I must keep going. If I don't do anything, if I do not study, if I do not go on seeking any longer, then I am lost. That is how I look at it. To continue, that is what is necessary. But you will ask, what is your definite aim? That aim becomes more definite, will stand out slowly and surely as the rough draft becomes a sketch, and the sketch becomes a picture, little by little, by working seriously on it. You said, we agreed in many things, but you added, since then you have changed so much, you are not the same any longer. Well, that is not quite true, Teo. If there has been any change at all, it is that I think and believe and love more seriously now what I already thought and believed and loved then. So you must not think that I disavow things. I am rather faithful in my unfaithfulness. And though changed, I am the same. And my only anxiety is, how can I be of use in the world? Can I not serve some purpose and be of any good? One feels an emptiness where there might be friendship and strong and serious affections, and one feels a terrible discouragement gnawing at one's very moral energy, and fate seems to put a barrier to the instincts of affection, and a flood of disgust rises to choke one, and one exclaims, how long, my God, how long? Well, what shall I say? Our inward thoughts, do they ever show outwardly? There may be a great fire in our soul, and no one ever comes to warm himself at it, and the passerby sees only a little bit of smoke coming through the chimney and passes on the other way. It was at this time that Vincent decided that he had to paint. His life was already a shambles. He was 32 when he did his first paintings. He found a room in Brussels. He brought to it a woman of the streets who was in labor and took care of her. The woman's mother was against her living with Vincent because she thought she could be more productive if she stayed on the streets. And Vincent wrote, well, gentlemen, which is the more delicate, refined, manly, to desert a woman or to stand by a forsaken woman? This winter I met a pregnant woman deserted by the man whose child she bore, a pregnant woman who in winter had to walk the streets, had to earn her bread. You understand how. I took that woman for a model. I could not pay her the full wages, but thank God I have been able thus far to protect her and her child from hunger. It seems to me that every man worth his salt would have done the same in a similar case. What I did was so simple and natural. But now the woman is attached to me like a tame dove. I, for my part, can only marry once. And how can I do better than marry her? She is coarse, plain, and pitted with smallpox, and probably has venereal disease. And her name is Christine. I will decide to leave her for a time, or forever if things turn out so, but I tell her, perhaps you will not be able to keep quite straight, but go as straight as possible, please. As long as I know that you try your best and don't lose hold of everything, that you are good to the children, as you know I have been to them. If you only act so that the children always find in you a mother, though you are but a poor servant, though you are but a poor whore with all your damn faults, you will always in my eyes. He left her. And the next day, her mother found employment for her on the streets again. And he went to the coal mining village and lived with the potato eaters. I shall stay here for the rest of my days.
In fact, I have no other wish than to live deep in the heart of this country. I feel my work lies here, so I shall keep my hand to the plow and cut my furrow steadily. Vincent was, in his work, always a Dutchman. The Dutch have this fascination with portraits and landscapes, and their work is very dark, probably because of the nature of the land and the geography. So in spite of all kinds of influences with Impressionism and Neo-Impressionism, he still maintained a kind of expressionistic idea. And in his early work, it shows in terribly somber color. He loved the common laborer. And he did portraits of the weavers and the potato eaters and the miners. But he saw in them people in real trouble. And when he tried to take their side in a strike dispute, the owners of the mine reported him to the bishop and said they wanted Vincent removed from this place. And so the bishop requested that Vincent no longer serve as pastor to the coal miners and the potato eaters. Even in Paris, in a place that is supposed to be very bright and jolly like Moulin Rouge, Vincent's paintings are dark and rather dangerous. But of all the early paintings, this is probably my most favorite. In Rembrandt, we'll see Thursday that he messed around with light an awful lot. And Rembrandt's paintings seem to have two different light sources, one coming from outside and one coming from inside, and Rembrandt saw, and Vincent saw that. And because Vincent had taken up with Christine, people no longer wished to associate him. He had more or less kissed the leper and had, by doing so, confined himself to isolation, and his models became things rather than persons. And he began painting humble stuff, but they all seemed to be icons with light coming from inside of them. If I could even look at a pair of boots like Vincent painted them, I might become a hiker. He did study with Impressionists and started imitating their style with little dots of pure color. But you can tell already a tremendous difference between this and Impressionism. Some of you may be familiar with Monet's water lilies and that kind of thing, which is just pure, soft color floating around. Renoir's portraits of beautiful women are not really studies in personality so much as they are studies in light, but not Vincent. Vincent's Impressionism is a study in his own person. After leaving that parish, he spent some time in Paris and just sort of physically, emotionally, mentally, every which way, went downhill. He got very sick, wound up in the hospital. I think Christine laid a particular malady on him. And he had to undergo all kinds of treatment. But in Paris, he met Gauguin and decided that what he should really do in order to perk up his health, his body, and every other thing, he thought he ought to go south and seek the sun. And so he went to Arles. And there is a time in Arles like no other time in the history of art. And you can pin it down from the 21st of February, 1888, to the 9th of May, 1889, just a little over a year, this man produced such a flood of important art that no one has ever been able to explain how it was happening, except that he was mad and possessed. But as soon as we look at the first paintings from Arles, we'll see that he has left the North Country almost immediately. He did about 40 self-portraits. Every one of them is different, and every one of them is supposed to have looked exactly like he did. About the first thing that attracted Van Gogh when he got to Arles was this bridge. And he wrote to Theo that he wanted to get colors into it, like stained glass windows and a good bold design. But weather kept hampering him. So on bright days, he would paint this kind of painting of the bridge. And on gray days, he would paint this kind of painting. He was obsessed by everything, but probably nothing obsessed him more than orchards. He went totally off the wall in orchards. I think he did about 50 or 60 paintings of orchards. I am up to my ears in work, for the trees are in blossom. And I want to paint a Provençal orchard of astounding gaiety. I have a fresh orchard as good as the rose-colored peach trees, apricot trees of a very pale rose. At the moment I am working on some plum trees, yellowish-white with thousands of black branches. I am using a tremendous lot of colors and canvases, but I hope it isn't waste of money all the same. I am well started now, and I think I must have 10 more the same subject. You know, I am changeable in my work, and this craze for painting orchards will not last forever. You will see that the rose-colored peach trees were painted with a sort of passion. I have still another orchard for you, but for heaven's sake, send me paints without delay. The season for the blossom is so soon over. Please, send me a penny. Here is the other middle piece from the 12 canvases, Theo. The ground violet in the background. A wall with straight poplars and a very blue sky. The little pear tree has a violet trunk and white flowers with a big yellow butterfly on one of the clusters. To the left in the corner, a little garden with a fence of yellow reeds and green bushes and a bed of flowers, a little pink house. There now, you have the details of this decorative scheme of orchards in blossom that I have planned for you. Theo, please send money. Theo must also have been a saint. The Mediterranean has the colors of mackerel. Changeable, I mean. You don't always know if it is green or violet. You can't even say it's blue because the next morning the changing light has taken on a tinge of rose color or gray. Now that I have seen the sea here, I am absolutely convinced of the importance of staying here and of absolutely piling on, exaggerating the color. Africa is not very far away. In the letters, you get the impression from letter to letter that he is searching for a home. Every place he goes, he is convinced that that is going to be his home, and it never is. This is La Mousse May. A young girl painted like the Japanese paint. The Mediterranean has the colors of mackerel. Changeable, I mean. You don't always know if it is green or violet. You can't even say it's blue because the next morning the changing light has taken on a tinge of rose color or gray. Now that I have seen the sea here, I am absolutely convinced of the importance of staying here and of absolutely piling on, exaggerating the color. Africa is not very far away. In the letters, you get the impression from letter to letter that he is searching for a home. Every place he goes, he is convinced that that is going to be his home, and it never is. This is Lamus May, a young girl painted like the Japanese paint. I never paint portraits on commission. I never paint notabilities. My sitters are non-entities, simple men and women that I want to paint because I want to. I am now at work with another model, a postman in a blue uniform, trimmed with gold, a big bearded face, very like Socrates, a man more interesting than most. I do not know if I can paint the postman as I feel him. He's a revolutionary. He is probably, though, a good Republican because he wholeheartedly detests the Republic, which we now enjoy, and because in the end he begins to doubt, to be a little disillusioned as to the actual Republican principle itself. But I once watched him sing the Marseillaise, and I thought I was watching 89. Not next year, Teo, but that of 99 years ago. My friend the postman lives a great deal in cafes and is certainly more or less of a drinker, but he is so much the reverse of a sot. He is so natural, so intelligent in excitement, and he argues with such sweep in the style of Garibaldi. He has often to carry loads you would call very heavy, but it doesn't hinder him, and he has the strong constitution of the peasant, from always looking well and even jolly. Van Gogh painted the postman Roulin 6 times. I can just imagine being Van Gogh's postman, delivering the mail and not being able to get away. My favorite portrait of Van Gogh's is this one. Theo, you are shortly to make the acquaintance of Master Patience Escalier, a sort of man with the hoe, formerly cowherd of the Camargue. It really is a pity that there are not more Sabot pictures in Paris. I do not think it would be an insult to Lautrec at all to put my peasant beside his, and I am even bold enough to hope that mine would gain by the odd juxtaposition, because that sun-steeped, sun-burnt quality, tanned with burning sun and swept with air, will show up still more besides all of Lautrec's rice powder and elegance. What I am learning is that Paris is leaving me. I am returning to the ideas I had in the country before I knew the Impressionists, and I should not be surprised if the Impressionists soon find fault with my way of working. I use color more arbitrarily than they, so as to express myself forcibly. I come even to orange tones, chromes, and pale lemon yellow. Beyond the head, instead of painting the ordinary wall of a mean room, I paint infinity, a plain background of the richest, intensest blue that I can contrive, and by this simple combination of the bright head against the rich blue background, I get a mysterious effect, like a star in the depths of an azure sky. In the portrait of the peasant, I worked in this way, but without wishing in this case to produce the mysterious brightness of a pale star in the infinite. Instead, I think of the man I have to paint, terrible in the furnace of the full harvest, the full south, hence the stormy orange shades, vivid as red-hot iron, and hence the luminous tones of old gold in the shadows. Blue is my color of infinity. Yellow is my color of spiritual light. Yellow is the utmost clarity of love. I want to paint men and women with that something of the eternal which the halo used to symbolize, and which we seek to give by the actual radiance and vibration of our colorings. I am hard at it, painting with the enthusiasm of a Marseillaise eating bouillabaisse, which won't surprise you when you know that I am at the painting of some great sunflowers. That would have surprised me. What this man could get excited about is beyond belief. Now that I hope to live with Gauguin in a studio of our own, I want to make decorations for the studio, nothing but big flowers. If I carry out this idea, there will be a dozen panels, so the whole thing will be a symphony in blue and yellow. I am working at it every morning from sunrise, for the flowers fade so soon, and the thing is to do the whole at a flash. Today I am probably going to begin the interior of the cafe where I eat by gaslight in the evening. It is what they call here a café de nuit, staying open all night. Night prowlers can take refuge there when they have no money to pay for a lodging, or are too tight to be taken to one. All those things, family, native land, are perhaps more attractive in the imaginations of such people as us, who pretty well do without native land or family either, than they are in reality. I always feel I am a traveler going somewhere and to some destination. If I tell myself that the somewhere and the destination do not exist, that seems to me very reasonable and likely enough. To the great joy of the landlord, of the postman who I've already painted, of the visiting night prowlers and of myself, for 3 nights running I sat up to paint and went to bed during the day. I often think that the night is more alive and more richly colored than the day. This picture is one of the ugliest I have ever done. I have tried to express the terrible passions of humanity by means of red and green. The room is blood red and dark yellow with a great billiard table in the middle. There are 4 lemon yellow lamps with a glow of orange and green. Everywhere there is a clash and contrast of the most alien reds and greens in the figures of little sleeping hooligans in the empty, dreary room in violet and blue. The blood red and the yellow green of the billiard table contrast with the soft, tender Louis XV green of the counter on which there is a nosegay in rose color. This is a place where one can ruin oneself, where one can run mad, where one can commit a crime. I have tried to express, as it were, the powers of darkness in an atmosphere like a devil's furnace of pure and pale sulfur. I show you this next slide to show you why we shouldn't be sitting here at all looking at slides, but maybe go over to Holland and look at the paintings themselves. There is no way that you can get a feeling for the real color of these things without actually seeing them. This is Vincent's little yellow house. The subject is frightfully difficult, but that is just why I want to conquer it. It's terrific. These houses, yellow in the sun, and the incomparable freshness of the blue, and all the ground is yellow, too. This may have been Vincent's only home. The idea of the house is a place of rest and beauty. It makes up for those things, family, native land, that I have not. The simple room is a vision of splendor and power in the existence of material objects, each having its identity. It's a poor man's room. But every piece of furniture in it becomes an image of creative force. Well, now, yesterday I was busy furnishing the house. Just as the postman and his wife told me, the 2 beds, to be really substantial, will come to 350 francs apiece. So I had to go on another tack. I have bought 1 walnut bed and another in white wood, which will be mine, and which I'll paint later. If Gauguin comes or someone else, there is his bed ready in a minute. I have bought two chairs, a mirror, and some small necessary things. Then there will be my own bedroom, which I will want extremely simple, but with large, solid furniture, the bed, chairs, and table, all in white wood. The room you will have here then, Teo, or Gauguin, if Gauguin comes, will have white walls with a decoration of great yellow sunflowers. You will see these great pictures of sunflowers, 12 or 14 to the bunch, crammed into this tiny boudoir with its pretty bed and everything else dainty, for it's going to be, I hope, a real scheme of decoration that I'm about to begin. As I've told you already, I am going to paint my own bed. There will be three subjects on it, perhaps a nude woman, I have not decided, or perhaps a child in a cradle, I do not know. I bought of set purpose a mirror good enough for me to be able to work from myself, because if I can manage to paint the coloring of my own head, which is not to be done without some difficulty, I shall likewise be able to paint the heads of other good souls. I have just bought a dressing table with everything necessary, and my own little room is complete. Color is to do everything, and giving by style and grandeur, the bedroom simplification is to give it life. I have had a longing on me for such a long time to do a sewer, but the things I've wanted for a long time have never come off, and so I am almost afraid of it. The outcome of this is a picture only a little over a foot high. But it is immense, Teo. It is immense. I have an Arlesienne at last, slashed on in an hour. Background pale lemon, the face gray, the clothes black, 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 with perfectly raw Prussian blue. She is leaning on a green table and seated on an armchair of orange wood. I tried to be religiously faithful, while nevertheless taking the liberty of interpreting by the medium of color the sober character and the style of the drawing. It is a synthesis. Take this as a work belonging to you and me, as a summary of our months of work together. Gauguin came. They worked together for a while. I can at all events tell you that the last two studies are odd enough, a wooden rush bottom chair all yellow on red tiles against a wall. Then there's Gauguin's armchair, red and green, night effect. In these two studies, as in others, I have tried for an effect of light by means of clear color. But it is certain that Vincent painted these chairs not just as still lives, but as symbols of some very deep-seated difficulty he was going through at this time. For the thing with he and Gauguin didn't work out at all. They fought constantly over the validity of style and the meaning of color as symbol or just pure expression. And Vincent's moods got very deep and angry, and once he threw a bottle of absinthe at Gauguin, and once he tried to slash him with a razor, and Gauguin spent the night in a hotel and wouldn't go back to the yellow house. And Vincent was incredibly depressed. Gauguin, returning in the morning, found the police and a crowd around the little yellow house. Van Gogh had cut off his ear. And when he had staunched the blood, he'd wrapped it up and taken it to the concierge of a brothel, saying, "Here is a little souvenir of me." He was taken to a hospital, and Gauguin telegraphed Teo, and Teo came to take care of Vincent. Teo wrote back to his fiancée, "While I was with him, he had moments when he was well, but after a short time he reverted to his ravings about theology and philosophy. It was a most pitiful thing to witness. Because now and then he thought of all his troubles, and then he tried to cry, but he could not. Poor warrior and poor, poor sufferer. Théo and Gauguin returned to Paris. The good postman Roulin, with the help of the charwoman, cleaned up the bloody room, and Van Gogh was shortly thereafter able to go back and visit. When I come out of the hospital, I shall be able to take the little old road here again, and soon the fine weather will be coming, and I shall begin again on the orchards in blossom. I must go back to the hospital now, but shall soon be out for good. And on the back of this letter to Théo, he wrote a note for Gauguin. My dear friend Gauguin, a few words of very deep and sincere friendship. I should like you to refrain until after riper reflection on both sides from speaking ill of our poor little yellow house. This is Madame Roulin rocking a cradle. And as he saw her rocking a cradle, he remembered a legend from Brittany that in stormy weather the fishermen saw an old woman sitting in the bows singing lullabies to them, and they did not fear her but felt safe. The idea came to me to paint such a picture, the sailors who are at once children and martyrs, seeing it in the cabin of their boat, should feel the old sense of cradling come over them and remember their own lullabies. A woman in green with orange hair stands out against a background of green with pink flowers. There is an attempt to get all the music of the color here. His physical condition continued to deteriorate, and he moved around between Saint-Rémy and Auvers, back and forth to home, painting scenes of the night and scenes of anguish, torment, all of nature alive but not at rest. This painting, probably one of his most famous, Cornfields and Cypress Trees, was a subject that he almost liked to look at rather than paint, which made it very rare. I would like to make something of those cypress trees like the canvases of the sunflowers. It is beautiful in line and proportion as an Egyptian obelisk. It is a splash of black on a sunny landscape. But they didn't come out like celebrations. They came out like swords. They say, and I am very willing to believe it, that it is difficult to know yourself. But it isn't easy either to paint yourself. I am working on two paintings of myself at this moment for lack of another model. One I began the day I got up. I was thin and pale as a ghost. It is dark violet blue, and the head is whitish with yellow hair. There is again the memory of a star in the depths of an azure sky. Indeed, everything is agitated except the piercing resolution of my eyes, which is the star in this azure sky.